All across Wisconsin from Civic Media, this is Up North News Radio. Real information, good conversation. Unabashedly Wisconsin. Here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
Well, hey there, Wisconsin. Good morning. Welcome to the State of Common Sense here from the shores of Lake Wissota, where we are live on this Friday, June 2nd, 2023. It is another beautiful day up north, albeit a little rainy up here on the lake where it is 65 degrees right now. It's 62 over in Merrill. Down in Janesville, there's some fog and mist and 63 degrees. Plover coming in at 64. Arcadia at 65. And basically anywhere along Highway 53, it seems, there's been this little band of showers that has just been sticking around, basically from Arcadia through Eau Claire, Chippewa Falls, and up to Spooner near Hayward. And just in that corridor, you're getting the rain we've so desperately needed recently, especially for the newly planted crops. And so the lawns are finally getting watered. I can almost see some of the brown spots on my lawn getting greener by the minute. So we will take that and still have a very warm couple of days, a full forecast from Weatherology in just a little bit. Coming up on the show this morning, we've got coyotes and roadrunners and wolves and sheep. And here, I'll explain what I mean. First, in terms of the coyotes and roadrunners, there's something about these budget fights. Whenever there's a Democrat in the White House and Congress is controlled by Republicans, the Republicans always force some kind of a face-off, and they always end up looking like Wile E. Coyote from the Roadrunner cartoons, whether it was Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Joe Biden. They all end up protecting most of the services that Americans have come to expect in return for paying their taxes. And the Republican demands for massive service cuts, well, they more closely resemble the tiny Acme umbrella as the anvil drops on their head. We will talk to Courier Newsroom national correspondent Kiev Akil for a breakdown of this week's events. Then Senator Tammy Baldwin is leading the latest bipartisan effort to find a practical middle ground in the debate over the management of the population of gray wolves in Wisconsin. And then we have our weekly visit with Mark Jacob about the national media outlets who seem so sheepish in covering the debt ceiling deal, choosing to both sides a hostage situation over the U.S. economy. Dan Schumacher will be along as well at show's end to talk a little sports. And all along the way, if you want to chime in with comments, especially about a topic I'm going to bring up in just a moment here, 844-967-2789. And then I also want to tease coming up on Monday, we will have Motherhood Mondays, and we will talk about LGBTQ parenting issues from a parent's perspective, from a kid's perspective, and so forth. But this is the time where we bring in one Aaron Zommers in Madison and say good morning. And remind me, you are not a Ted Lasso watcher, correct?
Correct. I have not seen it. I don't have Apple TV. So.
Okay. So, but that's okay. We're not going to get deep into, we're not going to get into any spoilers at all. So I want to stick to series finales overall, because I'm sure, well, you know, you can appreciate the fact that some series finales, you know, they hit the mark and others kind of a swing and a miss, right?
Yeah, there are definitely a couple of stinkers out there.
Yeah. I'm going to list a few, and then what we're going to do at 6:50, we normally do our daily history lesson and music break. And then if folks want to call in and answer the question, what are some examples of your favorite or your least favorite series finales? We'd love to put you on the radio and have you tell us all about it. And I say all that because my wife and I did watch Ted Lasso, the series finale, last night. We actually watched the last two episodes back to back. And I think actually that's the way to do it, because how many times has the penultimate episode been the one that really kind of, you know, tears your heart out or sets up a cliffhanger or anything like that? I don't think you can judge any kind of finale based just on the finale, but how they set it up as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that at this point, a lot of show creators just acknowledge that and make the finale a two-parter or something.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, especially when you consider a series like Ted Lasso's run 3 years, you have all these subplots. And do you wrap them all up? Do you leave some people hanging? If you try to wrap it up, do you shortchange that particular side character? So again, we're not gonna get deep into that, except to say that it was a very satisfying ending. Would I put it in top 10? I don't know, but you know, if it's a feel good show, if you're a fan of the show and you haven't seen it, I'm not gonna dwell, because I'll tell you what, as I was looking at social media the past day or two, and there were people trying to drop in basically spoilers. I've never had to work so fast to pull my eyes away, you know, from a tweet or a Facebook post about, no, don't want to know. We're not going to do that here. And in fact, maybe there are a couple of other ones that came up over the past week. Succession, which I never got into. I watched the first episode, but never got into it. Barry, I watched most of the first season, and then I just never picked it up again. And that's a show I may come back to, but they just wrap things up. And maybe you have some thoughts on that. And we talk about good series finales because over the years, we've now seen some very bad ones. And I'm looking at you, How I Met Your Mother. So along with every good one, you know, MASH, you heard me talk about Newhart last week. You know, The Sopranos is one people debate back and forth, was it good or bad? You've got Lost and Seinfeld and Dexter as examples of really not good or satisfying series endings. Maybe Game of Thrones was one of those as well. We've got so many to talk about along the way, and we'll do that later this hour. But again, at 650, if you'd like to call in at 844-967-2789, we would be happy to chat about that a bit during our 6 o'clock hour. Then we'll prattle on for another hour. And then at 8 o'clock, Todd Albo, one last time before we really switch the schedules around and introduce some new shows. We stay put, but we're going to have some awesome new neighbors that we'll talk about in a little while as well. All that coming up on a Friday. You're up north.
I can't stop loving you.
I've made up my mind to live in memory.
Thought we'd just give away some of today's music lesson or music break and history lesson ahead of time. Ray Charles, the number one song this day in 1962. I Can't Stop Loving You. He held the number one spot. That was the number one song for 5 weeks, starting on June 2nd, 1962. The Up North newsletter comes out every morning, every weekday morning at about 5 a.m. It's not that Christina Lurie is up that early. She puts it to bed before she punches out for the day, but that way it's there right in your email box first thing. And then, of course, she joins us on Tuesdays as well to talk about some of the more positive stories that she has in the newsletter. And for example, as we told you this week, she has put together a four-part series for the short work week. So each day this week, she had split the state into four quadrants and put together a road trip bucket list for each of Wisconsin's four corners. And so not only does she wrap things up today with southeastern Wisconsin, but she provides links as well to the previous 3 days that you can catch and click on. Articles also include a Wisconsin author who is donating $500,000 to nonprofits. We talk about what the debt ceiling deal means for your money, how the Biden administration has been tackling the mental health crisis, and also what kind of gifts dads actually want for Father's Day. So you can get all of that by signing up for our newsletter at our website, and that's upnorthnewswi.com. Time for sports now. At 6:17, the Toronto Blue Jays beat the Milwaukee Brewers 3-1 on Thursday. Blue Jays starting pitcher Kevin Gausman pitched shutout baseball for 6 2/3 innings as the Brewers' bats just never got going. Freddie Peralta gave up 2 home runs in the first inning. He settled down and actually retired 14 of the final 16 batters that he faced, but the damage had been done at that point. The Brewers have now lost 5 of their last 7 games, and they have already left Toronto and arrived in Cincinnati for a 4-game series that starts this afternoon at 3:10. Corbin Burns will get the start. They have games this afternoon, Saturday and Sunday afternoons, and then again Monday night before they turn around and come home for a series that starts Tuesday against Baltimore. And we are going to be giving away tickets for next Wednesday night's game. We're going to give those tickets away on Monday and Tuesday mornings. So be sure that you are tuned in for that. A little update now on the investigation into a teacher in Wausau who had been directing racial and homophobic slurs at one particular student and is still teaching, and the student essentially left the school, has now graduated. A complaint was filed by the student and the parents. The school district initially dismissed it. Well, now we learn that that dismissal of the complaint has been overturned, and the story is far from done. And we learn most of these details from the fantastic reporting by Natalie Eilbert from the USA Today Network Wisconsin, which encompasses things like the Wausau Daily Herald, the Green Bay Press Gazette, and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Now, the complaint has been, or the dismissal of the complaint has been overturned, according to this story, because district officials didn't follow multiple rules regarding how such a complaint should be handled. You'll recall this is a student who was a senior, openly gay, academically successful, popular, active in the music and theater programs, but he stopped going to class consistently around April 5th when he and his parents filed the complaint because he no longer felt safe or comfortable returning to a place where he was basically being bullied, to hear him tell it, and in such a way that there were other witnesses to it. This band teacher reportedly used ethnic slurs on multiple occasions, made a joke in front of the class about how the student might want to wear a dress to prom instead of a tux, then engaged in other intimidating actions. Now, school district policy, according to Natalie Albert's story, provides for various protections for the complainant, but an attorney representing the family says the district did not give the student and parent any of those opportunities before reaching its decision to dismiss the complaint. They were not given a chance to review the evidence, submit questions for witnesses, or even respond to the investigation's conclusions. I mean, they cut the student and parents right out of the process. The teacher's conduct was described as racist or sexist in the report, and insensitive and unprofessional, and yet the official who conducted the school district's investigation, who was also the school's human resources director, offered no explanation of why that conduct didn't meet the definition of harassment according to federal civil rights laws, known as Title IX, that prohibit discrimination based on sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity. So now, as Albert points out in her story, this is the school district's investigation and dismissal of the original complaint that's now been overturned. There is also a school board investigation launched in the wake of board members hearing a litany of complaints about the teacher and complaints about how the district had been handling the matter. That investigation by an independent attorney on behalf of the school board is then separate from another one being done by the State Department of Public Instruction, which has the power to pull a teacher's license. And it's also possible that DPI might investigate or take action against the school district, not just the teacher. The school district, believe it or not, has still not given the parents access to the original investigative report, the one where they, the parents, weren't even interviewed. And the school district has rejected multiple open records requests by the USA Today Network Wisconsin. So the school district still has a lot to answer for on this, on their handling of this particular teacher on this particular matter. So stay tuned. We wanted to pass along that update. Another update comes to us from the town of Lac des Flambeaux and the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians, and a face-off that they've had over the town's access to roads on tribal land. There's now been some action. It sounds rather harsh, but I get the sense that while it appears harsh, it's merely a tool to help resolve the situation. So hear me out. The story, which I'm seeing here from Mitchell Schmidt in the Wisconsin State Journal, says that the U.S. Department of Justice has sued the town of Lac des Flambeaux over this ongoing dispute with the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Chippewa, arguing that the town's roads are now officially trespassing on tribal land. DOJ filed the complaint on behalf of itself as a trustee for the tribe, and it also involves 76 individual landowners in the area. The DOJ states the complaint is to protect land to which the United States holds title through the Bureau of Indian Affairs for the tribe and affected landowners. The whole thing is all about easements, basically permission to use some tribal land, to put town roads on tribal land. And that all has to do with the fact that the, you know, what had been, you know, the reservation there is not a solid block of land. Because of decisions made over a century ago, there were individual parcels of that land that were sold separately to individuals, to other individuals, or to logging companies, or to others. And so you have kind of a Swiss cheese effect on this land. But to get to the land, you still have to go through reservation land, which requires that permission, that easement. And that easement, you pay money for that. You say, okay, I will let you on my land. Here's what it's going to cost. But those easements expired more than 10 years ago. And the tribe has been waiting for the town of Lac des Flambeaux to work with them. When the town has tried to work with them, they've tried to get information from the federal government, from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and they haven't received much of any communication from there. The tribe felt that it had no choice but to finally put up roadblocks to say, you can't use these roads anymore. You've gone more than 10 years without paying for these easements. They felt like something drastic had to be done. Well, then the barricades came down in March after about a month and a half or so of them being up. Both the town and the tribe reached a temporary agreement. The town would pay the tribe $60,000 to keep the roads open for 90 days. Late last week, Governor Tony Evers and Senator Tammy Baldwin sent a joint letter to all the parties in the dispute expressing frustration over the lack of collective work done to resolve the issue, despite continued attempts by our offices to resolve this. Evers and Baldwin say this delay harms the people of Wisconsin, whether they are tribal members or impacted homeowners or other members of the community. A lack of action, they write, will not help tensions and are a threat to the well-being of the individuals directly involved and the greater community. What do they mean by a lack of action will not help tensions? Well, that's essentially a nod to the guy who represents that area in Congress, Tom Tiffany. One of many people who are trying to exacerbate those tensions. They're supposed to represent the entire region in Congress, but true to form, Tiffany has used rhetoric that's designed to foster negative feelings toward the indigenous population there. So what does this mean that the U.S. Department of Justice is now involved in this rather than the Bureau of Indian Affairs? Is it, how serious is this? And while I don't have any inside information or you know, legal backing on this, I can only share my impression of this as somebody who's watched these kinds of things as a reporter and as a legislator, is that rather than the Bureau of Indian Affairs trying to take the lead on this, by the Department of Justice filing the suit against the town, that becomes the conduit through which all the sides can broker a new agreement. In other words, that agreement will now be, in my estimation, the agreement will be an agreement to settle the lawsuit that the Department of Justice has filed, so that there is going to be this written record with legal consequences if, for example, the town agrees to an easement, but then again, you know, somewhere down the road, literally, stops payment, or an easement agreement expires and it isn't renewed. In other words, so a situation like this doesn't happen again. That's really what we're looking to have happen here, you would hope. And I have been under the impression that cooler heads have been prevailing in the wake of the roadblocks going up, that people both within the tribe and within the town have said, okay, let's try to work together on this. Not everybody, of course, feels that way. There are people with some very strong opinions, against people that they see as opponents in a matter rather than neighbors in a dispute. But I'm I'm still cautiously optimistic. I'd say actually more than cautiously. I am optimistic that this is going to get resolved, that it shouldn't have taken more than 10 years to get there, but that it is going to finally be done. And if we can keep the, you know, the Tom Tiffany's and the others from blowing this up out of an endless desire to divide people based on cultures and other matters, then we'll be in a better place. So we'll give you updates on that story as it comes along as well. Courier Newsroom national correspondent Kia Vakil is coming up next. You're up north. As we do every week at this time, we talk to our friend Kia Vakil, a national correspondent for Courier Newsroom based out in California, talking about some of the headlines of the week. Kia, good to see you. How are you?
I am well, Pat. Good to see you too.
Yeah, well, you know, after a short work week, we're happy to bring about Friday morning already to people. The week started with the discovery that over the holiday weekend that President Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy had reached an agreement in principle to fend off that whole thing about, you know, national default and the recession it would likely trigger. And so all of this shortened work week has been learning the details and getting the reaction. If we were going to give an overview and we look back on this week in terms of the reaction to getting this done, how do you think we're going to look back on this last week of May 2023?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think, you know, what the overview is, or what the look back will be, is that the White House and Kevin McCarthy reached a deal that no one loves, but could have been a lot worse. And that's not inspiring, I want to be clear. But the alternative was a default where, and, you know, nothing is final yet. But the alternative is a default where tens of millions of people would see, you know, their economic livelihoods at risk. And so this deal, you know, is, you know, a very much a compromise. You know, there are things that, you know, it's a deal that would suspend the debt ceiling for 2 years through the 2024 presidential election. So kind of moves that piece off the chessboard for the next 2 years, which probably everyone is happy with. It does cap government spending for 2 years, which is in effect a little bit of a cut because of inflation, rescinds some unspent COVID relief funds, moves around some money that was supposed to go to the IRS to cover other domestic programs. And the main thing that Democrats are unhappy with is that it creates work requirements for food aid for a subsection of adults ages 50 to 54 who don't have kids at home. And so we see a lot of liberals and progressives are upset about that. I will note there is another SNAP provision that expands benefits to without work requirements to veterans and homeless people. And so assuming those people are able to access those benefits, which to be clear is an assumption because quite difficult to actually get in touch with some of these populations. But if, you know, every one of those people actually use these benefits, it would be an expansion of SNAP and not a contraction. So it's very much a deal that, you know, you see the House Freedom Caucus, which is the most right-leaning parts of the Republican group, they hate this deal because, you know, it does have cuts, but it's not the, like, let's destroy government level of cuts that they want. And on the progressive side, you know, they're pretty unhappy about the IRS funding being moved around and the SNAP food restrictions. So what we're probably left with is it's going to be, I would venture to guess, between 230 and 260 votes to pass this through the House.
This thing has such a feel of a gang that can't shoot straight to it. And it really just seems to be a continuation of what Republicans go through every time. They are Wile E. Coyote. The Democrat in the White House, dating back to Bill Clinton, is the Roadrunner. And, you know, Newt Gingrich forced a shutdown, and they forced a shutdown under President Obama. And they've done the same with Biden. And each time you come out of it, yes, some people get hurt. Yes, there's sometimes a setback in the economy. But like you said, in terms of, you know, they want these punishing cuts that would just shrink what government does. And that's not how it works. People pay their taxes. They expect a certain level of services in return. And so, yeah, you're pulling money back from the IRS, but that only makes the deficit worse that you claim to be for. Yes, you tighten up work eligibility or work requirements for SNAP. But again, it only adds to the deficit because you're bringing in more people who are eligible to receive this. So people are still getting their services, and Republicans just end up getting a black eye every time. And the whole reason I bring this up, Kia, is that this year started with saying, all right, you guys are asking for big, big cuts. What is it you want to do? And it took them until sometime in March to put a plan out. And it's so reminiscent of the Affordable Care Act, where they say, we want to repeal and replace. What's your replacement? And whether it's the Affordable Care Act or this bill that would have slashed, you know, veterans' health care benefits and more, they just don't seem to ever be able to put forward a plan where a majority of the public would go, oh, yeah, sign me up for that.
No, and there's a very clear reason for that. It's because they do not have a remotely coherent ideology on policies or plans. They know what they hate, and that's pretty much everything. But they do not have a proactive policy that would actually address any of the real issues we're facing today. They have no plan on the debt beyond to destroy the government that tens of millions of people rely on. All of us, frankly, you know, if you drive on roads, if you go to public parks, if you go to send your kids to public school, those are all government-funded programs. And there is no Republican plan for those beyond privatizing or just killing them. And so what you see in situations like the debt ceiling is because, you know, they know they want to cut spending, but they don't want to touch defense spending. They don't want to touch veteran spending. They got sufficiently cowed into and bullied into not touching Social Security and Medicare. There's very little left. There's, you know, a negligent amount of the federal budget left. So they talk about what they oppose, but like you said, they do not actually have a plan. And the moment they start to get into specifics, their plan, what they would do, is so extremely unpopular that they have to back away. So the few issues where maybe their agenda is a little more popular, you know, or let's say 50-50, is, you know, immigration and just generally speaking on, you know, certain tax policy. But even on those, they go so far to the right that they do alienate most voters in the end.
So then the question becomes, when all is said and done, and let's assume that this continues to go through and everybody holds their noses and says, okay, we've managed to stave off default. Does Kevin McCarthy survive this? There's already rumblings in the Republican caucus about holding a vote and maybe kicking him out of the speaker's chair, you know, just a scant 4 months after he got into it. Does that part seem inevitable, that there's at least going to be a vote?
I don't know if it's inevitable. I think there's a decent likelihood, because all it takes is one person to force the vote at this point, I believe. So, you know, that could be Matt Gaetz, could be Dan Bishop, could be any one of these, you know, far right Republicans, but he would survive the vote. Barring something dramatic shifting, you know, he's got the support of Marjorie Taylor Greene. He's got the support of even many of the ones who are going to vote against this bill. And frankly, that's because he caters to them enough where they have some influence in a way that they may not have had under prior House speakers or House leader, Republican leaders. And that's because Kevin McCarthy is beholden to Trump. He's beholden to Marjorie Taylor Greene. He's trying to thread a needle of being semi-responsible. And that's kind of what you see in this deal, is he's trying to be semi-responsible while also being, you know, catering to his far right flank. And it's going to be very tight. You know, he may not get it done, but if he does, you know, I'm loath to give Kevin McCarthy any credit. I think he's a political coward. But, you know, if he gets a deal done, that's better than not getting a deal done.
It really is more like reality TV, you know, caucus survivor than it really is governing. But if you're going to give him credit for something, give him whatever they give the winners of Survivor in this case. Where they do excel, of course, is in culture war fodder. And there has been a lot of that. And we say that as we now move into Pride Month here in June, and you have seen Target targeted, you've seen Kohl's targeted, you've even seen Chick-fil-A targeted for being too woke. I don't know exactly how we summarize this week in culture wars, but it does seem they're even turning on their allies if you're turning on Chick-fil-A.
Yeah, I mean, it's just exhausting trying to keep track of who they're mad at in any given week. Because, you know, last week it was the Los Angeles Dodgers. This week, and it's Kohl's and Chick-fil-A. Last month it was Bud Light,
right.
Target, you know, these are giant corporations, most of whom donate to Republicans, some of whom also donate to Democrats. You know, these are decisions, these are companies making market choices. You know, if you so believe in a free market and in a capitalist economy, Target isn't putting out, you know, pride-friendly clothing because they truly care about, you know, LGBTQ people. They might support it on a broad level, but it's because people are buying it. They're putting that there because people buy it. The Dodgers, you know, had some event with a group that was controversial to the right. LA is one of the most friendly cities to LGBTQ people. It's a product decision, frankly. And so what you're seeing is the right just crack down on anything they think is woke, which can be almost anything at this point. You know, just showing a trans person or a gay person in an ad is now woke. Just suggesting they exist or have a right to have clothing catered to them is woke. Teaching Black history is woke. Talking about any sort of gay person in high school, apparently in Florida, or middle school is woke. So there's no limit to this. And as we enter Pride Month, frankly, it's really concerning the level to which the extremism is surging on the right. You know, we're seeing people calling anyone who shops at Target gay and a pervert, which is just so ridiculous. We're seeing, you know, there could be calls for violence. It's getting really, really approaching dangerous rhetoric. And so far, very few Republicans are actually, you know, criticizing it.
And I don't remember where I saw the post, but of course, as people are looking at the way that right-wing news networks have covered, you know, pride displays and drag shows and things like that, but then you look at their coverage of some of the more recent developments of clergy abuse in churches, you get, I think the coverage is something along the lines of 0 minutes. And so who's really looking out for the kids, I guess, is to me, it seems like a fair question.
Extremely fair. I saw a graphic or a comparison yesterday that Fox News devoted, I believe it was less than 30 seconds to covering there was a recent report out of Illinois about the clergy child sex abuse scandal there. And then they devoted something like 22 seconds to that.
22 seconds. Yes, I just found it. And 2 hours and 12 minutes against Target.
Yeah, and that's because, you know, they don't actually care about protecting kids. That is not the goal at all. If they did, they would fund childcare. They would fund programs that make kids safe and healthy. They would not cut SNAP. They would not cut Medicaid. They care about keeping kids on a very certain track of intellectual thought and giving parents the ability to control what their kids learn throughout the world. That's crazy. You can't control what everyone, you just can't do that. And that's not freedom of speech. That's not freedom of expression. It's authoritarian levels of control.
The problem is you were born anywhere from, you know, 300 to 1,000 years too late. You're looking to be a colonizer and maybe a missionary who conquers and imposes. And it doesn't work that way here in 21st century America. It just doesn't. Now, a week from now, we'll talk more about the presidential campaign of 2024, because we believe by that time what will be official is that former Vice President Mike Pence and former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie will be in the race. So I'm expecting we'll have probably a little more colorful conversation next week in terms of, you know, reaction from Trump or Trump supporters or things like that, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I would expect that Trump will greet that news, honestly, probably with joy. The more people who get in and split up the non-Trump vote, the better it is for him, you know. And let's be real, Trump is not guaranteed to win, but it's not going to be Chris Christie or Mike Pence who win. You know, Mike Pence appeals to, what, 6 to 7% of extreme evangelical anti-abortion voters. That's pretty much it. I don't know who else cares about Mike Pence. I don't know what the audience for Chris Christie is outside of maybe 20 New Jersey Republicans. So
I just don't understand the people that I still see with either Trump Pence bumper stickers or Trump Pence flags. knowing full well of the schism that's now there. So is it that you're willing to accept either one, even though they're essentially opponents now? Are you just too lazy? You haven't been able to buy a new sticker that commits to either Trump or Pence. But well, regardless, we'll watch how the reaction is. And then very quickly, one official decision that was made as we follow news in some of the other states is that in Pennsylvania, Doug Mastriano, who ran a very unsuccessful campaign for Pennsylvania governor, is apparently not going to run the next time up for U.S. Senate.
Yeah, he decided not to run. He is a state senator, I guess losing by almost 15 points statewide.
Not good for your brand. Yeah,
not great for your brand. And, you know, he has, I guess, at least enough self-awareness to know that against Bob Casey, who's one of the most popular incumbent senators in the country, he would probably lose by 20 to 25. So, it's realistically the right choice. But it makes that race more competitive because whoever does run is unlikely to be as unpopular as Doug Mastriano.
Ian McKeel, thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
You too.
This, of course, is Whitney Houston. One of those songs that immediately transports you back to a particular time and place, maybe a dance floor. Whitney Houston released her second album, the blockbuster Whitney, on this day in 1987, including I Want to Dance with Somebody. Also in today's history lesson and music break, the late Charlie Watts was born this day in 1941, longtime drummer for the Rolling Stones. Let's see, earlier we played a little Ray Charles, 1962. We've got one other on the charts. The number one song this day in 1945 was the Les Brown Orchestra featuring Doris Day with Sentimental Journey.
Gonna take a sentimental journey. Gonna set my heart at ease.
Number one songs change a lot between 1945 and 1987, don't they? Also on this day in 1953 was the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II at Westminster Abbey. She took part in what was the first British coronation and one of the first major international events to be televised. Dana Carvey is 68 years old today, born this day in 1955. We already played earlier, like I said, Ray Charles with I Can't Stop Loving You, the number one song of 1962. We move up to 1972. Wayne Brady, from Whose Line Is It Anyway? And Let's Make a Deal, he is 51 years old today. On this day in 1973, the second album by Wings, Red Rose Speedway, topped the album charts on this day, on the same day that a single from the album, My Love, hit number one.
And when the cupboard's bare, I'll still find something there with my love.
A little later, we'll play the number one song from this day in 1979, which was Hot Stuff by Donna Summer. On this day in 1986, Randy Travis released his debut album, Storms of Life, with songs including No Place Like Home.
Well, there's my easy chair, just sitting there. I've spent a lot of time.
That is one smooth voice on Randy Travis. Then you go over to 2002 on this day when the top of the album charts was Eminem with his fourth studio album, The Eminem Show.
Just follow me, because we need a little controversy, because it feels so empty without me. I said, this looks like a job for me, so everybody.
On this day in 2018, BTS debuted at number one on the album charts with Love Yourself, Tear, becoming the first K-pop group to break into the top spot in the U.S. So that's a look at some of the history lessons and music notes from June 2nd in history. Picking up where we started the hour, we'd love to hear from you at 844-967-2789 if you have certain nominees for best or worst series finale. It was something that was brought up from my wife and I watching the Ted Lasso series finale last night, and we, again, promised no spoilers about that. If you're a Ted Lasso fan and you haven't watched it yet, you're going to watch it anyway, no matter what I tell you. But I'm going to tell you, it's worthwhile. You'll definitely enjoy it. Let's see. Roger put in on Facebook, best finale, first place, New Heart. Second place, Happy Days. And his nominee for worst finale was 2.5 Men. And I honestly don't know that I saw the Happy Days reunion. I'm pretty sure I was in college at that point and kind of felt like I'd outgrown Happy Days. I think, the Ron Howard, Richie Cunningham character, I think he'd left and they tried to carry on without him for a while. But, you know, there's some shows that you come back at least for the finale if you can. And Happy Days must have apparently, been a good one, made a good impression with folks. Game of Thrones was one you did or didn't watch, Aaron?
I read the books. I have not seen the show. But okay. I heard a lot of opinions about the ending, and they were all in consensus that it was terrible.
See, I'm not in that. I'm not going to say the Game of Thrones series finale was terrible. I'm going to say it definitely could have been better. I'm trying to start. How much of a spoiler alert should we give on Game of Thrones? The person who ultimately ended up on top, yeah, nobody saw it coming. But if you're a book reader, it's not the world's biggest surprise at how things turned out. But that was another one, Game of Thrones, that had so many subplots, and it was impossible to do justice to all of them. And so when you're left with questions hanging, it means you don't get something very satisfying out of it.
Absolutely. And I think the fact that the showrunners had to create the plot on their own instead of having George R.R. Martin, since he never finished the book series, and let's be real, never will, because like you said, there's just too much going on to wrap it up neatly. And he's done a masterful job so far in the book series in tying everything together and keeping it going. But he also just keeps adding more and more in, and you can't wrap that all up.
I mean, honestly, talk about over-promising and under-delivering. How many books were there supposed to be total? 7?
I believe so. And there are 5, if I recall.
And we've been waiting for this next book since 2011, 2010.
We're going to be waiting forever.
And we're going to keep waiting. It's not coming. So yeah, the TV writers, they started out with this great source material, and then the author just kind of, let them down. Let's see. Dexter is one of those shows I didn't watch, but again, gets very low ratings for its finale. I know people who watched Lost on ABC and were so put off by that. And there's different shows that try to end on some kind of a dream sequence or something like that. Saint Elsewhere would be another example where the whole thing was apparently, one kid's, dream or fantasy or something like that. But you know what? Ever since Bobby Ewing was in that shower in Dallas, the dream sequence is, you're just never going to win with that as a writing tactic, I don't think, unless you're Newhart, the Newhart series finale. That's how you do a dream sequence, and I don't think you can touch that anymore. We've had the best and worst in dream sequences. I don't think you can pull it off anymore.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
Sopranos, again, I was not a regular viewer. Do you get the impression that people, was it just because the final scene left them unsatisfied that there wasn't closure on there? Was it that alone?
I think so. And sometimes endings that are not all neat and tied up are the best. So it's definitely a matter of opinion.
The 2.5 Men one, coming back to Roger's comment here, and again, you can call in with yours at 844-967-2789. The 2.5 Men one, now you had Charlie Sheen leaving, and he just assumed the show would crater without him, and instead it doesn't. It goes on for, how many more years after that. And so they have to do something with the Charlie Harper character. And it was pretty masterful at the way they kind of, I think they, in a way, from a narrative standpoint, they brought him back to life only to kill him again, in the series finale. But they went so over the top in the way that they did it that we got done with the show and we looked at each other, my wife and I, like, that was a series finale that was basically written in spite out of, Charlie Sheen leaving the show. I mean, they did what they could with Ashton Kutcher, but, series finales, it's a crapshoot either way. The Ted Lasso one was worth it. More in our next hour. You're up north.